the idea of new coal-fired power stations is ridiculous. Yeah. They're uninvestable. They're just, you know, the only investor that's expressed any interest in this since Malcolm Turnbull first talked about
Clive Palmer.
Was Clive Palmer, whose last brilliant idea was Titanic 2. And I think that gives you a sense of what the private sector thinks about this.
Well, hello everyone. And that was Mark Butler, who is the Shadow Minister for Climate Change in the Federal Labor Party. And this week, he's come into the Australian Politics Live, the podcast studio, for an extended conversation with me about a bunch of issues relating to energy and climate policy at the present time, ranging from the Finkel Report to the controversy surrounding the Adani coal mine and where Labor positions itself on coal looking forward. I'm Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia. So without further ado, I'll let you relax into that conversation, which I said canvasses a number of different issues that are important to people who care about climate change and energy policy at the present time. Grab a beverage, put your earphones on, and here it comes. So Mark Butler, welcome to Australian Politics Live, the podcast.
Great to be here.
Now, I want to start with the Finkel Review, which is, of course, the main issue in your portfolio at this point in time. But I think from the point of view of the listener, it's a bit hard to do a podcast on the Finkel Report, given it seems to be morphing and changing in front of our eyes in terms of how the government's responding to it. Do you think that the central recommendation of that review, which is a clean energy target, is already dead?
Well, I hope it's not. And I'm remaining optimistic that the government will be able to work through the mess it got itself into last week and actually have a constructive discussion with the states and territories through the COAG Energy Council and in due course with the opposition, because it is critical that this sort of mechanism, which will guide investment for the electricity sector for decades to come, have the support, as much support as possible, of both major parties in the federal parliament. So I'm going to remain optimistic. I think some of the signals, particularly over the last 24 hours around government investment or support for new coal-fired power stations, sends, at the very least, very confusing signals. I'm going to remain optimistic that the CET is still alive and there will be the ability to have a constructive discussion about it in due course.
Okay, well, let's remain optimistic, which is hard to do in this particular policy area, but it's nice. So let's remain optimistic at least for the next couple of thoughts. So assuming the clean energy target is not dead, assuming it's still alive, the Labor thus far has basically framed coal as a deal breaker for you. You've basically said if coal is in the mix, then it's not a clean energy target. So my question to you is this a sort of an opening of negotiations? Is this just what you would say at this stage of the proceedings? Because obviously trying to come to an agreement with the government is a dance between two parties. Is it your opening bid, or do you actually mean it?
Well, I actually mean it, in the sense that you can't have a clean energy target that brings in the dirtiest form of electricity generation. It makes a nonsense of the whole idea of moving to cleaner electricity generation in Australia. And we just have to be honest about where we're at. We have a very high polluting electricity system against all countries to which we usually compare ourselves, almost twice as polluting as America's, almost twice as polluting as the OECD average. 76% of the electricity generated in the national electricity market is from coal. We need to be honest about the fact we've got to get that down. So the whole purpose of a clean energy target or an emissions intensity scheme is to drive investment in genuinely clean energy, and coal-fired generation, even in its more modern unabated form, the so-called ultra super critical coal, which sounds like something out of a Marvel comic, but
or
even ultra
Star
super
Trek
critical
movie.
Coal, awesomely ultra super critical coal, is still by any stretch of the imagination high polluting electricity. So, you know, Finkel's report was based on the assumption, and you've got to recognise his report was a pretty conservative report in terms of ambition. It was still based on the assumption that a clean energy target would take in energy that produced less than 600 kilograms of carbon dioxide per megawatt hour. Now, there's no unabated coal that comes even close to that.
Yeah. So are you telling me that that's Labor's threshold in terms of assuming that the clean energy target survives, assuming that we're actually going to have a discussion about a threshold, are you saying that 600 is Labor's threshold?
No, I'm not saying 600 is Labor's threshold. We'd be interested in looking at a range of different options. But I think it's quite clear in my mind that guiding investment now and into the medium term for Australia is going to be overwhelmingly renewable energy with probably some gas-fired generation in there as well. Quite how much gas-fired generation will depend on how quickly storage is able to be deployed economically. But I don't think anyone seriously thinks there is going to be investment in new coal-fired generation in Australia. That's the overwhelming view of the industry. It's the overwhelming view of energy experts. So let's just be honest about this and construct a clean energy target around reality, which is not coal-fired generation.
And so, again, I'll press you just once more on this point. So 600 is not the threshold, but coal doesn't sort of enter the mix anywhere below, say, 750, and even then it might
be unabated coal.
Yep. So that, you know, even that might be a stretch, right? So are you saying anything? Are you saying 7 or 750 is too high?
Well, unambiguously, that is too high to be properly called a clean energy target. It's just way too high to be called a clean energy
target.
And
there's no circumstances under which Labor would countenance such a threshold.
Well, we haven't got a proposition yet. I mean, I'm just responding to the Finkel report, which is a big shift for us. We've moved away from an emissions intensity scheme, which wouldn't be raising these sorts of issues because, you know, incumbent and new coal-fired generation would be effectively paying a carbon price directly to cleaner energy. This is a new sort of model that we've been presented by Finkel. In shifting from the position we took to the election to a clean energy target discussion, we've said, look, we're open to this, but we haven't fixed on a particular number. We are talking at a high-level principles point at the moment, which is, okay, if we're going to talk about a clean energy target, we've got to talk about clean energy and unabated coal-fired generation, whether it's critical, supercritical, ultra-supercritical, or awesomely ultra-supercritical, mm-hmm. It's not clean energy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So now let's move away from the clean energy target for a minute and into what the government's been talking about this week in various forms, which is some sort of reverse auction system to deal with the dispatchable power problem. This started basically, it was around in dispatches at the beginning of the week. It's come out of the mouth of Craig Kelly, who is the chairman of their backbench committee, came out of the mouth of the Prime Minister and the Energy Minister on Tuesday. What do you think of reverse auctions as a method of dealing with the dispatchable power issue?
Well, it's a pretty extraordinary addition to the debate. Let's remember the Finkel report's now sort of 10, 11, 12 days old. They've parked the central recommendation, which is the clean energy target. Now, whether it's parked to be
permanently abolished
or parked to be brought back on, we still don't know. But in its place, there's this idea of a reverse auction, which actually came out of the Minerals Council, which has been walking through this building over the last couple of days, arguing that there should be effectively a power purchase agreement or a power supply agreement funded through government for two new coal-fired generators, two very big new coal-fired generators to replace Hazelwood that's already closed and Liddell in New South Wales, which is scheduled for closure in the next 5 years. And this is an extraordinary intervention by government to say that they would be open to using taxpayers' funds to build new coal-fired generators that investors and banks have said are effectively, to use their words, uninvestable. Now, it remains to be seen whether this is a pretty weird thought bubble that the Prime Minister has floated just to placate the hard right in his party room and get through this week without having something more permanent done to the clean energy target idea, or whether they're genuinely serious about this. If they're genuinely serious, I think it's the most bizarre intervention in the electricity market that we've seen for decades. What you have to do, given that you won't have private investors lining up, what you have to do to de-risk this sort of investment will run to extraordinary sums of money.
You've got to indemnify them against future risk, don't you?
You've got to indemnify them against future risk around a carbon price that everyone accepts is inevitable in the medium term, if not the short term. And you've got to indemnify them against regulatory risk as well. Now, remember, the International Energy Agency recently published, or late last year, published a report about what it thinks needs to be done to the energy sector worldwide to keep faith with the Paris commitments to keep global warming well below 2 degrees. And it says that unabated coal-fired generation really needs to be closed by the mid-2030s in OECD countries, unabated coal-fired generation. So banks and investors, read these reports. This is not Greenpeace. This is the peak body for the energy sector worldwide. It reads these reports and says, well, there is, might not be having this discussion in the parallel universe that is the Parliament House in 2017, but in the 2020s, certainly in the 2030s, the IEA says that governments will have to think about regulatory decisions around unabated coal-fired generators. I mean, that is a serious investment risk to something that, if you built it, if you made the decision now, probably wouldn't open until the mid-2020s, and then would be an investment expected to repay investors for 40 years beyond their time horizon.
This is
why private investors are looking at unabated coal-fired generation, much more than bemusement.
Yes. Well, with not a great deal of interest.
No interest whatsoever. Yeah. So it's sort of this parallel universe thing that the coalition party room is in. And I think, you know, younger Australians particularly pick up, well, I don't imagine many of them are reading The Australian today, but pick up the front page of the Australian newspaper or the Financial Review that says their government wants to invest in new coal-fired generation, and they must be scratching their head.
Well, let's just assume, just for a sec, that let's take the coal plants out of the mix. And let's just look at reverse auctions. Let's not assume that the Commonwealth is actually seriously contemplating indemnifying two large new coal plants, although, of course, they might. But let's just assume that doesn't happen. Let's think about reverse auctions as a means of solving the dispatchable power issue. Have you got any problem with that?
Well, it's a question of how you do this. Now, reverse auctions are increasingly common around the world, particularly for implementing renewable energy targets, particularly over the last sort of 5, 6, 7 years, they've become the orthodox way to implement renewable energy targets around the world. So you've got to find a way to blend that with a market that gives investors the confidence to pull their wallet out of their pocket and start putting billions of dollars on the table in a way that gives them confidence that it's not going to be subject to bizarre decisions by government that cut across their investment. So I think you can blend these things. The ACT has done it very well in terms of deploying their renewable energy ambitions, which all operate within a national renewable energy target. So you've got to get the blend right. Yeah, you've got to have a market system that gives investors confidence. But if then there is a decision that says, well, we want a particular level of generation in a particular region of the national electricity market, like New South Wales or Victoria, then reverse auctions might be a way to draw investment to a particular region. But it's got to be done in a way that still gives investors confidence.
Mm. Mm. And it doesn't. Let's just say the reverse auction system is actually replacing the clean energy target as some sort of a scheme. Well, it doesn't deal with the overall target of how you reduce emissions either.
It's kind of ad hoc. They say we reckon 3,600 megawatts needs to be replaced because two coal-fired generators are closing. Well, that's all well and good to say that, yeah, there's the loss of that generation. Of course, we need new generation of some type. But what we need, what everyone has said for years now, that we need is a whole of system investment framework. And that's what a clean energy target gives us. And this sort of ad hoc weird idea that the Prime Minister came up with yesterday doesn't.
Well, I think am I summarising you correctly if I say that you could look at reverse auctions in certain circumstances, but certainly not if they've got two big coal plants attached to them. Is that reasonable?
The idea of new coal-fired power stations is ridiculous. Yeah. They're uninvestable. They're just, you know, the only investor that's expressed any interest in this since Malcolm Turnbull first talked about
Clive Palmer. This
was Clive Palmer, whose last brilliant idea was Titanic 2. And I think that gives you a sense of what the private sector thinks about this. As to reverse auctions generally, they can't be ad hoc. I mean, they've got to operate within a broad, stable system that gives investors very clear signals for the long term about what we want from electricity generation. Now, whether there can be some coexistence between a clean energy target framework that operates across the national electricity market and reverse auctions of the type that the ACT has been implementing, Victoria wants to implement. I think there's a useful discussion there, but that's not the discussion Malcolm Turnbull tried to start yesterday.
Well, not so far, but, you know, we've got a road to travel, I suspect, on this whole issue. What about the issue more generally of whether or not governments should invest in new energy infrastructure? Obviously, in your home state of South Australia, Jay Weatherill's talking about building a gas power plant, right? Mm. What's your position on that? Should governments invest in big thermal generators or co-invest or indemnify such projects or not, just as a point of principle?
Well, I think there are some states, obviously, still where the assets are owned. So Queensland, for example, is one of those where the state government is essentially the driver of these investments. More broadly, for the national electricity market, I think governments have to be very, very careful about this. I mean, after the South Australian government, which is in a reasonably unique situation, after it made its announcement about supporting a government-owned, essentially peaking plant to deal with very high levels, very infrequent high levels of demand, there was a bit of pushback from the market. AGL, for example, said that meant maybe they were going to shelve their plans to build new gas-fired generation, or particularly to replace Torrens Island, which is the big gas-fired generator in Adelaide. Since then, they've come back to the table and said they are going to invest in new plant in South Australia, as they've looked through the details of the intervention that the South Australian government has made. They are, I think, now feel comfortable that this is an intervention which is not going to provide a serious interruption to the market. So, you don't rule it out, but it's got to be done in a way that is carefully calibrated to make sure that investors aren't scared off, particularly at a time now where we desperately need investment in the market. Like, we're having generation leave, and we're not getting generation built because for 4 years now we haven't had an energy market framework, except for the renewable energy target as a bolt-on. There's been no investment framework. So the last thing we now need to do is to, after receiving the Finkel report, within 2 weeks, have the national government, the Commonwealth government, start to say, well, you know,
another round of ad hoc.
We're in. So all of your plans for investment in New South Wales or Victoria, you better put them on the back burner for a while because we might be getting into the market.
What about is there a case in the same in principle fashion for governments to invest in carbon capture and storage or clean coal technology per se? Is there a case to do that? Because obviously there's, you know, the proponents suggest that one can achieve emissions reductions and particularly in the industrial sector. So is there an in-principle case? And obviously there is a practical case before the parliament where the government wants to change the investment rules of the Clean Energy Finance Corporation. So what's your position in principle and what are you likely to do on that CEFC legislation?
Well, in principle, we think there is a strong case for government supporting research and development areas in new technology and in innovation. And carbon capture and storage is potentially one of those technologies, although I think the economics of it in power generation have sort of moved on from the position 10 years ago, where I think most people, including the International Energy Agency, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, thought at the time that carbon capture and storage might be an economic technology in power generation along with renewables. That hasn't really worked out. But carbon capture and storage in the industrial sector for steelmaking, cement making, I think will be critically important for us to achieve economy-wide big reductions in carbon pollution across the world, not just here in Australia.
So does that mean does that mean you're likely to support the CEFC change?
No, we won't be supporting the CEFC change.
Not at all.
No, won't be supporting. We've made that decision.
Announced that decision?
Yes, we have. Because this technology is and the government has criticised us about it in the parliament. So there has been a debate about that announcement. But the point I make about CCS, both in power gen and in the industrial sector, is they are emerging technologies. They are still at the R&D stage. Now, when we were in government, we put significant money into research and development for carbon capture and storage. We had a carbon capture and storage flagships program and then a solar flagships program. Solar flagships got bundled into the Renewable Energy Agency or ARENA, but the CCS flagships program funded a whole lot of R&D at CSIRO, university and industry levels. that never really took off, I've got to say. And the coal industry, which was co-investing in that 10 years ago, started to pull its money out of R&D in the fund it set up to do that, which was called Coal 21. It now essentially funds advertising campaigns to promote coal, like the big black, you know, the little black rock or whatever that campaign was. It doesn't do much R&D anymore. And ironically, it was Tony Abbott that abolished every single dollar from the CCS flagships program in his first budget in 2014. Now, if the government had come to us or to the parliament and said, we recognise that Tony Abbott made a mistake in 2014 by strangling this technology at the R&D stage, we're now going to put more money back into R&D at this for this technology, we would have said, good. Fine, we think this is a technology that will be important in the industrial sector. But they didn't do that. They tried to pretend that this was commercially deployable. Now, the CEFC requires a commercial rate of return, about 6% rate of return on its loans. No one seriously thinks that carbon capture and storage is anywhere close to being able to be deployed at a commercial rate of return. It's misleading coal communities. It's trying to sort of, you know, score a point with the right wing of the coalition party room. And even if it did pass the parliament, I'm very confident, according to all of the advice I've received, there would be no projects lining up for CEFC funding because they're just not at that stage.
But there is a case perhaps to do some more R&D.
I think there is a case to do
seed
more
funding
R&D.
Or
I mean,
something.
Australia really should be a leader in that. We are, you know, the pretty much the most carbon intensive economy in the OECD. We've got great scientists. We've got a very big coal industry here, very big steel industry. This was one of the countries on the face of the earth that made sense to lead the way in R&D in this area, to do some demonstration projects. And I think it was very disappointing that the coal industry decided to pull its effort out some years ago. Now, whether they thought that, you know, Tony Abbott's rise meant that all of this stuff around climate policy was going to just go off the agenda, or whether it was because the coal price collapsed and their access to capital was limited, I don't know. But I think it was a pity either way. And it was a terrible mistake, I think, from the Abbott government to abolish that program altogether.
But then
pretend it's commercially deployable, that a technology that is just crawling can somehow now be commercially deployed. It's just not being honest with people.
Fine, but riddle me this. If you've got no issue with funding, seed funding for R&D, and you're okay with CCS for industrial processes and think it could be quite useful, why not change the CEFC's mandate? They've got very clear instructions about what they can invest in and what they can't invest in. If you're right and there's no commercially viable projects that would be likely funded by the CEFC, why not change the mandate and leave it to them?
Well, I'm not going to cooperate in a hollow gesture. This is a cynical hollow gesture by the government to try and pretend that they're supporting CCS by giving them access to a commercial loans facility when there's no way they can access that while having cut off their R&D funds. So if the government wants to have an honest discussion, like a constructive discussion about this, they need to think about R&D. I'm not going to cooperate in them essentially sort of presenting this hollow, cynical gesture to the right wing of their coalition party room and effectively lying to coal communities that this is some avenue that could provide a meaningful pathway in the near term. It just won't.
Okay, so let's stick with coal communities for the minute and Labor, and let's just think about a much more general question. We've been over a lot of specifics in this conversation. Labor, to my observation, the opposition in Canberra at the moment is probably the most progressive that it's been in 20 years in terms of its policy offering. I think that's a reasonable comment to make. So on the issue of coal, you've been trying to straddle this issue in quite delicate fashion, shall we say. At the one level, you're saying coal hasn't got a future. At the other level, you're saying you haven't yet, though, in your policy platform, adopted an anti-coal position. You're still trying to be astride the barbed wire fence on this issue because, for obvious reasons, you've got split constituency. This is an area genuinely in transition. So as the responsible portfolio shadow minister, how long do you think it will be before Labor adopts an anti-coal position in terms of its platform? And if you're the most progressive you've been in 20 years, why not do it now?
Well, because essentially because this thing is in transition and it's going to be a long transition. I mean, when I say I don't support new coal-fired generation, that's a genuinely held position that reflects, first of all, the weight of the obligation I think our generation has to reduce our carbon footprint to future generations, but also the economic realities of generation choices. So that really is what drives my opposition to building new coal-fired generation. At the same time, though, I recognise that coal-fired generation is going to be a part of the national electricity market for quite a number of years. Now, I think it's hard to tell how many years that will be, because renewable energy technology is developing so fast, storage technology is developing fast, and I think the reality of climate change is becoming clearer and clearer to people, that I think these debates may well move quickly through the course of the 2020s and certainly into the 2030s, I think. So, it is hard to be black and white about this. I mean, we do need to recognise that coal-fired generation will be a substantial part of the national electricity market, certainly while I'm in Parliament. And we need to build around that reality. The other thing is that vast tracts of coal communities in Australia are actually export coal communities, and they're thermal coal communities that are providing coal for power generation in other countries, and that has its own economics, which has driven a lot of my contributions to the debate around Adani, which I think is, from the government's point of view, built on a false premise. But then there's coking coal communities, particularly in Queensland, where they're providing coal. They provide about 50% of the world's coking coal that goes to making steel, and that has a very different economics behind it. So it is a complex area, and I think it sometimes gets oversimplified to be coal. And I just want to be honest with people in saying that this is actually quite a nuanced area.
It can be quite a nuanced area, but then at the one level, then how do you say, I don't think we should have any more coal-fired generation in Australia, and say, and on Adani say, oh, well, maybe. Maybe we'll let that happen. How do you reconcile those two positions? I know you'll say, well, Catherine, I reconcile them by what I've just said to you, that there are nuances in this debate, that it's not a simple black and white proposition. But you can see my point, right?
Yeah.
You in this portfolio are as close as you can possibly be to an anti-coal position, yet we still have hedges, particularly the most obvious hedge in the public domain at the moment is around Adani, that Labor federally is trying to walk both sides of the street on that issue. Mm. Okay, yes, if it meets all its approvals and fabulous, off it'll go, but we don't really like it and there shouldn't be any Commonwealth money. It's a hedge. Obviously it's a hedge. When are you going to get off the hedge? Or out of the hedge, Sean Spicer style. When are you going to burst out of the hedge?
Thanks for that.
Sorry.
Comparison. Look, on Adani, the issue before us is whether or not the Commonwealth should provide a loan. And we've got a very clear position about that. Beyond that, there are different assessments, I guess, people can make about the prospects of Adani. I have a very clear view that the economics of Adani don't stack up, and that it would not be a positive thing for Australia for the Adani mine to go ahead, because I think that all it would do is to take jobs from elsewhere in the coal industry. This is a zero-sum game, essentially, in a declining coal market, which is India. This is all built on apparently our obligation to provide thermal coal to India. And the coalition and parts of the coal industry talk about this in missionary terms often, that this is a moral obligation we have. And, electricity is great for humanity, and connecting Indian households is an important moral and economic and social
objective
purpose and objective that the Indian government has.
Yeah.
And government seeks support from the Australian government, then we should do all that we can. The problem with the chain of reasoning that the coalition runs here is that the Indian government, first of all, is doing pretty extraordinary things in connecting Indian villages to electricity under Modi, but it's not doing it with Australian coal. I mean, it is reducing its thermal coal imports at rapid rates.
Yeah, but you're listening to yourself, aren't you, when you say these things? You're making a number of compelling arguments for why Adani's a dog.
Yeah.
So why not just say Adani's a dog, we don't support it?
Well, I have said I don't think it stacks up. I've said that publicly, and I don't think, I think if it goes ahead, all it will do is essentially cut the lunch of another thermal coal mine elsewhere in Australia, probably in the Hunter Valley. Australia's thermal coal imports will probably be the same. India will continue to reduce its reliance on thermal coal imports, as it's doing and as it intends to do in coming years. Jobs that might be created in that part of Queensland will be offset by job losses in the Hunter Valley. I'm not quite sure what the national benefit is. Now, I understand why the Queensland government might be pressing this, but from a national perspective, I just don't think it stacks up. And the idea that governments would try to help it stack up with taxpayer money, I think is just a wrong-headed decision.
Sure. Well, then why does...
Now, just to take your point a little further, Catherine, I think Australia would be in a really interesting and very challenging position if, for example, the Modi government, let's think hypothetically, the Modi government said that, you know, I've got a plan, I've got an ambitious plan as the new Prime Minister of India to electrify Indian villages, and I'm going to do it on coal-fired generation. I'm going to expand coal-fired generation rapidly, and I need Australia to do all it can to dig as much thermal coal out of the ground as possible and send it to me as quickly as possible. Then we would have, I think, a very difficult discussion to have here. You know, I think see the ACF and others sometimes call it the drug dealer sort of quandary, but we're not in that position because that's not what Modi has said. The electricity plan his government released in December sees them not building a coal-fired generator for at least 10 years, but deploying 350 gigawatts of renewable energy. So we pretend we're in this sort of parallel universe where the Indian government is doing something which they're just not.
Okay.
Let's have an honest debate about what's happening. China's reducing their reliance on thermal coal quite significantly. America has rapidly reduced its reliance on thermal coal generation. There you have in three countries, three quarters of the global coal market. Sure. Like we need to be real about this.
No, totally. I am being real about it, and I'm asking you, like you couldn't be clearer. Basically, you think this mine should not proceed. It's not what Bill Shorten says, though. So how do you account for those differences?
Well, I think people take different views about the economics of this. I mean, I have a view about the economics. You know, we have a position as Federal Labor about the issue that is in front of the Commonwealth Parliament, and that is the provision of a loan. We have a very clear view across Bill, across, you know, my portfolio area, Jason Clare's portfolio area. The matter before us has been quite definitively resolved from Federal Labor's point of view.
Into different people saying different things. That's the truth of it. Your characterisation is different to Bill Shorten's characterisation of it. Some of your own people are saying just flat no hedging, no maybes. People like David Feeney and Peter Khalil and Lisa Singh are saying nah, just no caveats on it, just nah, that shouldn't happen. So there's a spectrum.
But these are not matters before the Parliament.
I mean, no.
Matters before us. And so I guess beyond the sort of matter that is before the party as a decision, which is the idea of a $1 billion loan to Adani, people will make different assessments about stuff that's not formally up for decision.
I see. No, on the point of the loan, you're all on the same page.
Yes.
Yeah. No, totally get it. All right. I think I've tortured you sufficiently. Thank you very much for joining us, Mark Butler.
Thanks, Catherine.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. We really do appreciate it. You can leave us a rating or a review on iTunes if that's where you download us from. The ratings and the reviews are always helpful in expanding the audience for the project. This podcast is produced by Miles Martignoni, who also produces the other podcasts for Guardian Australia, including Behind the Lines, and you can search for that in the same way that you search for us. We'll be back next week, as usual. Until then, take care.